Welcome to The Wire. Today, advocates say migrant women need to be given a bigger role in advising the government during the Melbourne lockdown. And overseas in Yemen, years of conflict combined with the COVID-19 crisis to produce a humanitarian catastrophe. And as facial recognition technology is used more and more in Australia, how can we protect our privacy? So stick with us, we'll have all of that and more for you over the next half hour. We're coming to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Today's show was made in Brisbane at Radio 4EB. My name's Stephen Regal. First up, even as the world deals with the coronavirus pandemic, the conflict-ridden Middle Eastern nation of Yemen faces one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. Courtney Thomas reports.
While Australia and the rest of the world battle the COVID-19 pandemic, Yemen faces one of the largest humanitarian emergencies. Since conflict worsened in the country in early 2015, experts say more than 80% of the population are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance, with more than half including children. Yemen faces water, respiratory equipment and sanitation supply shortages, as only half of their health facilities are currently functioning. Advocates warn if sufficient funding isn't provided, millions of people, including young children, could die from preventable diseases. UNICEF communications specialist for Yemen, Harriet Dwyer, says Yemen is facing a humanitarian catastrophe.
Yemen has been grappling with a civil war, which has led to an economic crisis and subsequently resulted in a humanitarian catastrophe where we've seen over 1.7 million children and their families forced to flee their homes. While the political context is important to understand, for UNICEF, our priority in Yemen is to respond to the needs of children who play no role in the fighting but continue to, despite this, carry the heaviest burden of the conflict there.
Ms. Dwyer says children in Yemen deserve the same basic human rights as children elsewhere.
While a sustainable solution to peace is found, we must continue to urgently respond to daily needs of children in Yemen by making sure that they have the water, the healthcare and protection services they need to survive and have an ability to look towards the future. So by investing in their education so they can rebuild. So UNICEF would like to remind the world that children in Yemen deserve the same rights of children everywhere. And we need the global community, everyone, to make sure that they're not forgotten.
She also says the world needs to pay attention to the crisis in Yemen so children receive the essential water, healthcare and protection services they need to survive.
For Australians, Yemen might seem like a faraway place that has no relevance to them, especially as we face the current COVID-19 crisis at our home. But we hope that because of the scale of the suffering there, people can educate themselves about the experience of families in Yemen. If they're able to, UNICEF in Yemen is facing a funding crisis where we will have to stop life-saving health services and cut water to millions of families. This is a devastating prospect in the middle of a pandemic. So we really need the world's support to keep communities from slipping further into catastrophe. So we really encourage people for more information or to support UNICEF's life-saving work in Yemen to visit unicef.org.au.
Professor of Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University, Greg Barton, says Yemen has a sad five-year history of war and poverty.
It's a sad history and it's involved decades of conflict, but it's involved an intense five-year, now going into 6 years, of civil war since an uprising in 2015. Before that, in 2011, the Arab Spring saw the overthrow of long-running President Saleh, been in power for 3 decades. He came back with a group called the Houthi Alliance, representing the 25% of the population who are Shia Arabs as opposed to Sunni Arabs, and they seized control in 2015. They've been at war ever since.
Professor Barton says people in Yemen are enduring unending suffering.
For 10% of the population living in the capital Sana'a or in the other large city in the south, Aden, there might be some sense of normality, but for 90% of the people, it's a completely abnormal time, although young people wouldn't remember that because they've been out of school for so long, they've been poor for so long. We see images out of Yemen of degrees of malnutrition that we thought were passed with the last century, just kids reduced to virtual skeletons. And this in an arid country where many of the streams and rivers don't reach the coast, the country is so dry, it depends on underground aquifers. So when there's civil war like this, people suffer from the arid conditions, but also because of supply lines being blocked, and many people are simply starving to death, or if not literally starving to death, suffering from malnutrition, which stunts kids and leads them very vulnerable to disease. So it's genuinely a hellish situation for 90% of the population, and one in which it seems to be unending suffering.
He also says the civil war can't be resolved through military means.
The Houthis are unable to win back more than the so-called North Yemen section on the western end of the country that they've got a historical hold on. They're not going to go beyond that. And their opponents in the south and the east are unable to push them out of power. The involvement of the Saudis and the Emiratis, backed with weaponry from France, UK and the US, hasn't been able to break the deadlock. So there needs to be an acceptance of a compromised peace deal that would essentially see some sort of federation.
And that was Professor of Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University, Greg Barton, ending that story by Courtney Thomas. The COVID-19 outbreak in Victoria is growing by the day. While the Victorian government is engaging with multicultural leaders on the crisis, advocates say migrant women are missing in the decision-making process. Eduardo Jordan found out more.
The Multicultural Centre for Women's Health is a migrant women's health organisation that's been going for 40 years. And our main work is to provide health education to migrant women in Victoria about a range of health in their language. We started off going to visit migrant women in factories in the late 70s, and we still continue to reach women who are the most disadvantaged in their workplaces or in community settings. Of course, now with COVID-19, we couldn't do face-to-face work anymore. But we now reach women via other means. So we're running Zoom sessions in their language. We're doing radio.
That was CEO of the Multicultural Centre for Women's Health, Dr. Adele Mujolo. A large number of migrant and refugee women have been affected by the COVID-19 full lockdown public housing towers initiated by the Victorian government. Most of these women don't speak fluent English or don't speak it at all. Dr. Mordolo says the state government didn't provide enough multilingual information at the beginning of the pandemic.
We've been speaking to government from very early in the piece with concerns that there hasn't been enough multilingual information for migrant communities. So there has been quite a lot of information developed and put on websites, but what we were seeing was that that information wasn't being conveyed to communities where they lived. So there was a gap between the development of the information and the receipt at the other end by the communities, and a gap that was actually even wider for migrant women. We were quite concerned about that. So we think that there has been a better response in the recent months, where we've seen an increase in cases in communities where there are larger proportions of migrant communities. So I think that became very clear to the Victorian government that they needed to do more.
But Dr. Mordolo says information isn't the only thing he's missing. Migrant women don't have a voice in the decision-making response to the crisis. Dr. Mordolo says this is vital to these women in the community.
Decision-making goes much beyond an individual decision-making about the self. It really is about being a part of the community and having so much to contribute to the community in understanding what the response needs to be. So I think that we need to plan for these crises with women's issues at the front of our minds, not as an afterthought. So I think that if we were able to incorporate what the issues that women face in the planning and in the response, we would be thinking straight away of what the issues women are going to have. So if women and migrant women in particular were involved in the planning for how we address these disaster responses, then we would be able to build and embed migrant women's issues into the response from an early point rather than addressing them as an emergency later on down the track.
She says overall migrant women need more support during the COVID-19 crisis.
And we also have been talking to the Victorian government about providing telephone information to migrant women who are living in public housing so that they can have the information they need in their language about what COVID-19 is, how to prevent it, what the testing achieves, what they can expect, and of course all of the other issues that are related to COVID-19 that affect women, like COVID-19 and pregnancy, parenting concerns, mental health, family violence, all of those kinds of issues.
That was CEO of the Multicultural Centre for Women's Health, Dr. Adele Mordolo, speaking to Eduardo Jordan earlier. Privacy advocates have expressed concerns over the expansion of facial recognition technology in Australia after retail chain 7-Eleven recently announced they were using it in all of their stores. They're not alone, with Federal Human Rights Commissioner Edward Santow recently saying there aren't strong enough protections in place to prevent the misuse of facial recognition technology in activities like policing. For more, I spoke to Adjunct Professor of Law and Criminal Justice at the University of South Australia, Rick Saar, about this earlier.
Facial recognition technology has been used by governments for a long time. Anyone who's been overseas or has got an electronic passport in the last, I'd say, decade would know that facial recognition technology has been coming in at our borders. And every time one now leaves Australia, a photograph is taken. In fact, every time you go to the United States, your photograph is taken as well. For a long time, police have been using facial recognition technology, not so much in this country, but certainly in the UK and America, to highlight people who might be a terrorist threat. What we're now seeing, of course, is that it's becoming cheaper and more readily available, and so private institutions are using it. And until I saw this piece, what, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, saying 7-Eleven were using it, I had no idea how widespread it was in the private sector.
So when it comes to private companies using this technology, what kind of provisions under the law can people count on to protect their privacy?
The law around this began some, I think 3 decades ago with the passing of the Privacy Act 1988, a Commonwealth bit of legislation, because back in 1988, the only thing that we were handling or dealing with was personal data. In 2001, that was shifted across the private sector as well. So if you're a business of more than $3 million, you have to go through the so-called privacy principles, etc. What we're now seeing, of course, is in the last half a dozen years, the technology expanding rapidly into facial and other surveillance technologies. And we're just finding it very difficult for governments to keep up. In fact, I pointed out to someone yesterday that every state has passed listening devices legislation since the 1970s. Every one of them, except even 3 jurisdictions, have now updated that to include not just listening devices, but surveillance devices, meaning cameras. So we're still stuck with old legislation that talks about data. Now, obviously, facial recognition technology is involved in data, but it's encrypted data. It's very specialized data. And I'm simply making the point that if we want to have some degree of control over the privacy aspects or the lack of privacy aspects of this new technology, governments have to take a firm hand and say that we have to reshape the Privacy Act to encompass this whole idea now of surveillance and facial recognition technology to ensure that we don't go down the path of the more authoritarian regimes like the Chinese.
So what would be a good way of protecting that particular aspect of privacy? Would you suggest that people have a right to fair use of their image, for example?
Well, they do. Under the privacy principles, a person has a right to see what their image looks like and to get some information about that and to correct it if they've got the wrong name, for example, or there's been a mistake. But no one knows that that's there. Very few people are going to be going down that particular path because they're probably not worried by it, or will actually think they're probably more secure by going into a store where their facial recognition has been recorded And indeed, the legislation also demands that once the purposes for which that's being used have been exhausted, and of course that's a fairly vague term, that data needs to be destroyed or at least de-identified. I just don't think they're serious enough. I don't think there's enough government control. Now, at the moment, there's a parliamentary committee looking at data matching to ensure that the sorts of data that's being taken by governments and the big telcos, for example, are not matched and are not shared and are not passed on. And hopefully the parliamentary committee can come to some agreement about what legislation is required to update the privacy legislation.
And that was Adjunct Professor of Law and Criminal Justice at the University of South Australia, Rick Saar, speaking to me earlier. National Diabetes Week will raise awareness of the condition affecting more than 500 million people worldwide. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Professor of the Department of Diabetes at Monash University, Merlin Thomas, about new research on diabetes and why education is important to prevent the condition.
Could you please tell us a little bit more about the National Diabetes Week next week?
Next week will be National Diabetes Week, and this is all about raising awareness of the importance of diabetes, its many manifestations and complications in the Australian community. It's a really important issue, even while there are other medical things going on, like COVID and all sorts of other things. Diabetes is a really serious issue for many Australians, and it's worth raising the profile of it, and more needs to be done.
Now, with the actual pandemic going on, why is it important diabetics take care of themselves?
A lot of people have got into their minds that, you know, COVID has been this enormous epidemic. But if you look at the data from, for example, people with diabetes, in Australia today, there were more people who developed diabetes today than developed COVID. When you look in the world, the number of people who will die this year from their diabetes will be over 7 to 8 million people, which was more than COVID. And every year it seems that there are more and more cases of diabetes. You know, there are 500 million individuals globally who now have diabetes. And this is a really serious thing. It's probably the biggest epidemic to ever sweep through human beings. And as a result, it's really important that people not only do what they can do to prevent it, but also more people are made aware of how it's treated appropriately and effectively to improve the outcomes of those with diabetes.
Now, how many Australians have diabetes and what's the best way to prevent it?
So currently in Australia, it's thought that there are at least 2 million individuals who have diabetes. It's expected that, for example, a 20-year-old today in Australia, when you look at their future, their risk of developing diabetes is somewhere between a third and a half. Data from America would suggest it's more like a 50% chance of you developing diabetes during your lifetime. And that is a serious long-term future risk. The nice thing is that when you look at data from many countries, it's very clear that improving your diet, improving your lifestyle can also significantly reduce your risk of developing diabetes. And by that, I mean by reducing it by over half. So it's really important to say diabetes is preventable by doing simple things every day to reduce your risks.
Professor, what's new in research to detect and or to prevent diabetes?
Well, there are a number of things going on in diabetes research, both ways of detecting and ways of treating diabetes. Of importance, every doctor has available to them in Australia very simple ways of identifying those individuals who are at risk of diabetes and then doing a very, very simple blood test to ensure to establish whether they have or have not got the disease. This test, at least the screening test before you do the blood test, is mandated to be done in all Australians over the age of 40, at least on every 3 years or more often in those who have high risk or are Indigenous background. And then going ahead for those individuals who are identified at high risk to get the simple blood tests. So that's what's out there. We don't need more tests and new research to get more tests. We just need more people to recognise that they need the tests. And it should be done at least every 3 years for every Australian during their adult life.
What's the role of education in preventing and controlling diabetes?
Education is really important for controlling and preventing diabetes. As an example, there was a study done in China some years ago known as the Da Qing study, where they took individuals and they subjected them to an education and exercise regime that involved changing their diet and increasing their physical activity. And these individuals were at high risk of developing diabetes. They had so-called pre-diabetes. This three-year program resulted in a 50% reduction in developing diabetes during that immediate follow-up period. But what was interesting is that after the study, then they all went home and did their own things that they normally do. Those people who had done their best to control their diet and to increase their physical activity were not only less likely to develop diabetes in the future, but also less likely to have a heart attack or die in the future than those who had not done the good things in terms of their diet and lifestyle.
And that was Professor of the Department of Diabetes at Monash University, Merlin Thomas, speaking to Eduardo Jordan there.
A different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
Before we end today's show, The Wire would like to acknowledge the life of an important community member who made contributions to the advancement of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders over several decades. Indigenous people are advised the following contains information about a person who is deceased. This was adapted from a statement issued by the deceased's family. Lyle Munro Sr. was a prominent leader from early on. He was on the Maori Aboriginal Advancement Committee while a resident on the Maori Aboriginal Mission, and was elected to the New South Wales Aboriginal Advisory Council in 1969, directly advising the New South Wales Minister for Aboriginal Affairs. He was involved in the Freedom Rides when they drove through Maori in 1965. Mr. Munro Sr. was elected as Deputy Chair of the National Aboriginal Conference, and in 1979 accepted the task of treaty negotiations with the Fraser Liberal Coalition government. He actively contributed to the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody and was a long-serving chair of the Kamilaroi Regional Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission. He was an active member of the community, holding positions in numerous organisations, including the Maori Aboriginal Sobriety House, Maori Local Aboriginal Land Council and community housing organisations. Mr. Munro Sr. was also involved in the establishment of numerous community bodies, including the New South Wales Aboriginal Legal Service, Australian Legal Aid Commission, the Pious X Aboriginal Corporation, Aboriginal Legal Service Moree, and many others. Later, in retired life, he worked tirelessly for the recognition and creation of a memorial to honour the Mile Creek Massacre, serving as co-chair of the Friends of Mile Creek Committee since its inception and creation of the memorial in 2000. Lyle Munro Sr. was recognised as a silent achiever in the year 2002, jointly receiving the National NAIDOC Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Male Elders of the Year Award and the New South Wales Law and Justice Foundation in 2013. He continued to advise and consult on issues relating to Aboriginal affairs and mentored many Aboriginal leaders and politicians. He passed peacefully surrounded by members of his large family and will be deeply missed by the Gumeroi Nation and by the wider Aboriginal community throughout Australia. For those who wish to watch his funeral, it will be streamed online tomorrow, the 11th of July, at newsouthwales.gov.au/state-funeral. That's The Wire for today. Thanks for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a collaboration between Radio Adelaide, 2SER in Sydney and 4EB in Brisbane, and we're produced with the kind support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and with the help of the Community Radio Network. You can listen to our show again, same time each weekday on your local community radio station. And if you'd like to keep up to date with what we're doing, just jump onto thewire.org.au for all of our stories and send us your story ideas. Or follow us on Facebook at The Wire Independent Current Affairs on Community Radio and on Twitter, The Wire Radio. Today's show came to you from 4EB in Brisbane. My name's Stephen Regal. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.